This is Turn It On.
And welcome to episode 42 of Turn It On. My name is Michael J, and this is my podcast. Thank you so much for joining me. I am very excited. Mr. Billy Sheehan is here today. I've been teasing this episode for a few weeks now on social media, and the day is finally here. That talk is coming up in just a few minutes, and I promise I'm going to get to it fast. But before I do, it's time for everyone's favorite segment, something I call
Stories from the Road.
That, of course, is the jingle for Stories from the Road, a soundbite that is definitive proof that I still have the sense of humor of a 12-year-old boy. You're welcome. Since this is a big and momentous episode of the podcast, I'm going to take just a little time out to tell a short story that pays tribute to a friend of mine. This is less of a story from the road and more of a story about the way being a musician has shaped my life. It's a story of kindness. I moved to Gainesville, Florida way back in February of 2000 with my then girlfriend. She'd gotten into school down there and my band Exploding Boy had broken up and I was playing solo acoustic gigs all over town to put food on the table. It was a pretty rough time financially for both of us, and I'd landed a weekly gig at a place called the Grog House in Gainesville after hitting it off with the bar manager, a guy named Wilbur Wu. Wilbur was a really big guy, former football player, and I used to watch him challenge college guys to drinking contests by saying he could down an entire pitcher of beer in the time that it would take them to chug a pint, and he won every single time. It was pretty incredible. Wilbur and I became fast friends, and anytime he thought he could help me make extra money by throwing me gigs at the Grog House or helping to get me booked elsewhere around town by spreading the word, he would. He would treat my girlfriend and I to lunches and dinners and movies all the time. Even though we would try to pay, he would never let us. That's just the kind of guy he was. And Wilbur was placed in charge of buying a new sound system for the Grog House and started getting musicians' friend catalogs in the mail. And he was spending a lot of time getting my opinions on gear and doing tons of research to make sure that the club got the most for their money. The Grog House was one of only a few places in town where I didn't have to bring my own sound. And the system I was using at the time was really small and almost borderline ineffective for the places I was playing, but I was making do with it the best that I could, and it was falling apart, and my only acoustic guitar had also seen much better days. Like I said, lean times. Anyway, I never thought it was anything out of the ordinary when Wilbur would ask me about gear because I'm a musician. We all love talking about gear, even with people who don't know the first thing about it. He would ask me things like, what would you buy to play around town if you could afford to, and what kind of acoustic guitars do you like, etc., etc. I didn't really think much of it. Anyway, this went on for a while until one day. My phone rang, and it was Wilbur. He asked if I was home, which I was, and then he said, cool, I'm outside your place right now. Come out. And when I walked outside, he was standing in the driveway with two brand new Yamaha 12-inch PA speakers with a matching 12-inch PA monitor. And next to all that was a Gibson guitar case with a brand new black Musician's Friend exclusive model Gibson acoustic guitar in it. And these were all things I had mentioned in passing to Wilbur when we would talk about gear. I was in disbelief and half in tears, and I kept saying, it's too much, and I can't take this, and things like that. And he just looked at me and smiled, and I'll never forget what he said. He said, it's too late, man. It's already paid for. You need to take it. Take it and go be successful and keep making music. I hugged him and I lost it. And it remains to this day one of the sweetest gestures that ever has been bestowed upon me by anybody. And sadly, not long after this, Wilbur was hospitalized with congestive heart failure and passed away. He was only in his early 30s at the time, and his death hit me and much of the Gainesville community very, very hard. He touched everyone's lives in much the same way he touched mine. And I'd like to think that he'd be really proud of all that I've been able to achieve up to this point if he could see me today. So I'd like to dedicate this episode of the show to my friend Wilbur Wu. Gone, but never, ever forgotten. And that is this week's installment of
Stories from the Road.
right, it's time. Billy Sheehan, what can I say? Talis, David Lee Roth, Mr. Big, Niacin, Sons of Apollo, the Winery Dogs, and the list continues. I met Billy last year at the Nashville Drummers Jam tribute to the late Pat Torpey, drummer for Mr. Big. I reached out to Billy recently about being on the show, and much to my surprise, he said yes. He was kind and generous enough to invite me to his home here in Nashville, and we sat down and had a great talk on a very stormy night, and I am just going to get the hell out of the way right now and let you hear that. So this is me and the amazing, legendary Billy Sheehan.
Jonathan, I liked him. Just a likable guy.
Yeah,
it's kind of interesting the vibe you get of somebody off the stage. You make up your mind about a lot of things.
Yeah, right.
And I just seemed like a likable, pleasant guy. And all the stories I hear from Ray is wonderful to work with. So
yeah, and Ray's a monster.
Ray's an easy guy.
Yeah.
He's great.
Have you been playing with him for a while? Or?
Quite a while. He did my second and third solo records.
Okay.
And we performed live a couple of times.
Yeah.
But I remember when I saw him first, he was at the Viper Room in L.A. and they were doing what eventually became Steel Panther.
Oh, okay. Ray played with Steel Panther?
It was, okay. It was an entourage of people that would do those copy tunes.
Yeah.
Things. And the place is packed and it's after the NAMM show and everybody from the NAMM show is there and I didn't know him. We're all sitting around talking, and the band's playing. And I go, wait a minute. Is it me, or is this drummer kicking complete ass?
Yeah, right.
You know, who is this guy?
Right, right.
So I met him then, and we were in touch and worked together. I love working with him, so we're going to just bass and drum thing we're doing together. So
okay.
Hopefully, at some point, we can perform what we're doing.
Yeah, well, let me know. I'd love to come see that. That'd be cool. Great. Yeah, Ray's a lot of fun to watch, and it's like, it's one of those things, man. It's I met you at the Drummers Jam the first time, the tribute to Pat.
Oh, great.
And for me, it was like watching you play. It was the first time I'd ever seen you play, but I'm from Rochester, New York.
Okay, great. Yes.
And so,
next city over for me.
Yeah, right. And as a kid, Talis was sort of spoken about in sort of quiet reverence in a way. Well, it's kind of funny because that was my first introduction to who you were and you're playing, all that kind of thing. It was like one of the guys, I probably was a fifth grader, and we were starting up a little band in someone's basement. I think one of the guy's older brothers had a drum kit down there.
Yeah.
And I want to say that his older brother used to go see Talis quite a bit in Buffalo and was always telling us, oh my God, Talis. And I want to say there was a bootleg cassette of...
I've digitized most of them.
Oh, have you really?
Yeah, I had a huge pile of cassettes, literally like this high.
Right.
And I sat down with two double cassette players.
Okay.
Each one had auto reverse.
Yeah.
And I would just open up 8 tracks, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, on a Pro Tools document.
Sure.
Hit record and then hit start on all 4.
Okay.
And I eventually got them all. Then I had to go back through them and figure out what was what. But there's still some I haven't gotten to. But
okay.
But there's a whole bunch of those talents.
Yeah. Give me a sense of what was happening in Buffalo at the time, because I the bands I started playing in were years after that. So I have no frame of reference for what was going on. Like what was kind of happening? Was there a big scene of bands or
Buffalo was quite a phenomenon. It's kind of a shadow of its full self.
Mm-hmm.
Buffalo was one of the most important cities in America because that was all of the produce and products from the Great Lakes, which included almost all of Canada and everything west, had to get to the Great Lakes and had to go by ship because you couldn't go over land.
Sure.
And the last city before Niagara Falls where you couldn't go any further was Buffalo.
Right.
And so that was where everything had to go from Buffalo, and then either around and then back to Lake Ontario and out.
Right.
Or somehow down to New York City. Yep. And then that's when they built the Erie Canal.
Okay, yep.
And it's funny because I read a book about it. The guys that they hired to build it had never built a canal before. They had no idea what they were doing.
kidding.
They just took the job. But they managed somehow to build a canal.
They're right.
and it ended up in New York City. And New York City wasn't that big of a deal at that time.
Uh-huh.
Wasn't until that canal
right.
ended there that all the shipping
sure.
now to
okay.
Europe had to go from New York City.
Okay.
So Buffalo was actually higher on a scale at
right.
one point than New York was. And a lot of its architecture shows that. People
yep.
do architectural tours in Buffalo. So it had a lot of importance historically prior to that. And then uh-huh. musically, it's still, that comes with the territory. A big city will have a big music scene.
Sure.
So by the time I started to perform live, which was 1969-70.
Okay.
There was a huge explosion of bands. But even prior to me, the generation just before me,
yep.
the guys I learned from.
Yeah.
There was, I remember listening to local radio, and every night was bands playing here and bands playing there, and all these band names that we begin to recognize because hear their commercials. And then they'd put out local records,
okay.
and it would always be a thing going on.
Yeah.
Local TV shows, and the bands would be on
sure.
there. We had the Invictas, the Road. Wilmer and the Dukes. They were actually
yep.
a Rochester band.
Yep, yep. Heard of them.
They played
in
Buffalo
yeah.
a lot.
Sure.
A zillion bands
right.
from back in the day. That was a good way for every generation to step on their shoulders next. And my generation came along. I started playing, like I said, 69, 70,
right.
71. There were already a zillion clubs.
Right.
And everybody had live music almost every night of the week.
Were these cover bands or were they doing their original material? Or what
mostly cover bands.
Okay.
But just like the scene in Hamburg, Germany with the Beatles,
sure.
everybody was a cover band.
Sure, right.
Until you started to write your own stuff.
Yeah,
and then,
yeah, yeah.
then you had to figure out how to fit that in without
yeah.
getting in trouble. And then eventually, it's a good training for a writer because you're testing it out in front of a live audience
right.
that night
right.
and performing it.
Yeah.
Two things that a lot of writers don't ever do
right.
now.
Oh, yeah.
They never get to play it in front of a live audience to see if it works.
Sure.
And they certainly don't get that feedback from an audience
right.
that you get right away to see if it's working or not.
Right.
So it was a perfect storm of great things
yeah.
available.
Yeah.
We had just so many opportunities to play so much. So by the time I was playing regularly, we did 21 nights in a row once.
Good God.
Locally.
Wow.
That's three or four sets per night.
Yep.
Setting up your own gear, tearing it down.
Sure.
Getting up the next day.
And the
day.
Gear was bigger back then.
Oh, it was giant. We had a lot of stuff. We had a trailer on a station wagon, then somebody would get a van, and then you get a little
sure.
bigger truck and
yeah, yeah.
You know, graduate up. And then eventually bands would graduate to their own sound systems because the clubs didn't really have sound systems like they do now.
Oh, okay.
You'd show up and you'd play through what you had.
Okay.
You'd bring your own stuff in.
Right.
And so
what were the vocalists doing?
They were carrying a lot of Shure Vocal Master columns, they were called. Shure Vocal Master was a little amp with a mixer on it, so you could put
okay.
several vocal mics on it.
Interesting.
There.
Okay.
And a custom with
yeah.
a upholstery.
Yeah.
They made the same thing. And a couple other companies made these columns.
Yeah.
They were like long, skinny speakers you put on each side of the stage
okay.
and sing through. So there was a dedicated singer's amp
right.
and gear.
Yeah, yeah.
Shure also made a couple little mixers that you could plug microphones into.
Okay.
Initially, when we started, we took a Fender Dual Showman, which is a four-input amp.
Sure.
You're only supposed to use one input at a time. And we would plug four microphones into it.
Oh, God.
Now channel one and channel two, or input one and input two on channel one
right.
were different volumes.
Right.
So whoever got a channel or input two had to sing louder
okay.
because
yeah.
it wasn't as loud.
Right.
So all these little makeup things you had to do for lack of technology or
sure,
gear
yeah,
or
yeah.
the things that weren't even invented
right,
yet
right.
were really great training in how to solve a problem as it relates
yeah.
to performing, playing, singing,
right.
harmonizing,
right.
hearing. We never had monitors. There were no,
okay.
no such thing. I remember the first time I saw a monitor on stage was in the mid-70s. What? Why is there a speaker out there? What's this
yeah.
doing here?
Yeah.
We turn the PA a little bit so we
yeah,
can
yeah,
kind of
yeah.
hear
sure,
it on stage.
Sure.
And that's why it was our monitors.
That's how you did it. Yeah.
And I hear tapes from us back then. Everybody's singing on key.
Right.
It was okay, you know.
Well, it's like I've heard stories about the Beatles when they were doing their thing that they were pretty on all the time, too.
Listen to the Shea Stadium and they're
right.
they're on. And that comes from the same thing. You play in clubs night after night after night after night.
Yeah.
And you're in front of a critical audience, because if they don't like you, you'll know about it, you know? You know, and it's a bar too. You can, you know, somebody's like, you suck, you know?
Right.
It's going to happen. So you have to do good. It's a great kind of pressure. So I was really lucky to start at that time when I could just play constantly. And you get experimental, and it's late at night, and you're on the last set, not too many people there, and you start jamming and going off. And that's why I did my first on a company bass solo. We were doing the song Mr. Big by Free. Okay. And it has a kind of extended bass solo jam in the middle. So one night at the Poor House West in Hamburg, New York, I said to the guys in the band, hey, when the solo comes up, you know, just look and count it off and just stop. And I'll go. And they go, really? Yeah, that's right. I said, hey, stop. And I did my whittly thing. And
yeah.
Come, 3-4, come back in. And we ended the song. And,
right.
And that was the first time I did an unaccompanied solo. And it was funny because people responded like, what in the world just happened, you know?
Right.
Mostly they wanted to dance. And a couple people complained that we weren't playing a beat, so they couldn't. But other people were like, wow, that was kind of cool. And at the time, it's funny, I posted a photo of us playing at He and She's, another club, early 70s, where I was wearing tall platform boots and crazy ass outfit.
Yeah.
And there's not a lot of, there's no people up front. Actually, some of the people at the front of the tables are actually turning around and looking. And so you get this impression from the photo that nobody cares what's going on.
Yeah, right.
But the way the club was configured, people nobody used to go up to the stage back in the day.
Really?
Nobody would go up and stand in front of the stage. It didn't happen. You'd be seated or sitting back or doing your thing. And most of the people would be way in the back of the club watching what's going on.
Yeah.
So it was interesting when I saw the comps. How come nobody's up front? They were, I remember. And I remember the first couple of times people would come up to the stage and stand there while we're playing. It was kind of threw us off.
A little weird, yeah.
But yeah, because mostly people were, you know, the dance floor in front of us would be empty, or the seats and tables in front of us would be kind of empty.
Right.
And everybody would be in the back of the room, because that's just how it was. Now it's the opposite. Everybody's up front as close as they can.
Yeah.
But it was interesting to see those little variations in how people responded in a club, what they did.
Yeah.
You know, you would never stand up and watch the band. You'd be back having a drink, trying to talk up a girl or ask a girl to dance or be with your buddies. And the band would be playing also.
Right.
And so having that degree of indifference from the audience really forced you had to come up with some dancing monkeys or circus act to get people's attention on stage.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And again, that's good training for just presentation, you know, how you get your music out there.
Did you ever have a sense when you started out that you were approaching the instrument in a different way than anyone had ever done? Or was it just kind of, was that just what came out of you?
I never thought of it much until we started to play more outside of Buffalo.
Okay.
Because we played there, people got used to it. They saw me do my thing, and okay, he plays a bassy little solo thing. whatever.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing. And then we started to play out of town, and people were had never seen me before. I don't want to sound self-aggrandizing, but they were taken back. Like, whoa.
Right.
What? How? Who? And it's funny, because just recently somebody posted some solos that I had done in about 1984, two of them. And I'd never seen them before, and somebody posted them. I've seen almost everything of me. I got an extensive, thorough archive. And I don't know how I did some of that stuff.
Yeah.
And it was all right, and I was hitting the notes, and I'm going to hit a couple clam notes here and there.
Sure.
But it was really funny. So it's hard to get an objective point of view of your own self, let alone how people view you.
Right.
You know, and again, it wasn't until we started to really move around that people began to, you know, the buzz started happening.
Yeah.
To the degree where I'll jump ahead in time.
Yep, sure.
We're opening for Van Halen in 1980.
Uh-huh.
They didn't know us from Adam.
Right. You
know, they didn't know who we were.
Right.
We got the gig through the booking agent, Premier Talent.
Okay.
And we're in the, you know, they were busy, and we were off in some dressing room.
Right.
People think, open up for a band, you get to hang out with them.
Yeah, no, that's
it. Generally, no.
Not how it works, right. Yeah.
Not how it works.
Right.
So we're in the dressing room there, kind of excited to be opening up for Van Halen. The dressing room was like an L-shaped room. I'm sitting there. I can see the door. No one else can see the door but me, where I'm sitting.
Right.
And they said later, man, you had the weirdest look on your face. And in the door comes Ed Van Halen.
Right.
And I had never met him before. Yeah. And the first thing he says is, which one of you guys is Billy Sheehan?
Really?
And I went, me! Okay. I am! Yeah. That's me! You know, but he had heard you know, out in California. This is 1980. Right. I'd already kind of heard it was kind of with no real record deal or anything like that. So that there rumors did float around, right. Not like they do on the internet now, right. But there still was a way for people to find things out.
Yeah.
So as I began to play, I was fortunate enough that people were kind enough to accept and enjoy what I was doing, and they told their friends about it. So the best form of advertising, word of mouth, happened. But for myself, I was just fixated on more and better. And every time I achieved anything as a player, I instantly moved on and found something else that I couldn't do at all.
Right.
So I was in a constant state of frustration of trying to do this one thing that I can't do.
Yeah, yeah.
Forgetting that I was leaving a trail of things that I had been able to do.
Sure.
Because I just never looked at any of that stuff. Then I get up there and play all that stuff and thinking nothing of it. And somebody goes, wow, where did you get that from? I don't remember. It was way back. So it was an interesting evolution,
right.
You know, through time.
Yeah. So what, I always ask bass players this, what drew you to the bass? Because the bass guitar in my growing up, in my world, was reserved for the last guy.
Yeah.
Who kind of like, well, we've got everybody in the band. We need a, you know, now we need a bass player. You can play bass.
Yeah, guitar player. We already got one. Right. So we're going to switch you over to bass.
Exactly.
You
know? Right.
Your
right,
second
right.
string. Well, unfortunately, I wasn't smart enough to really realize that guitar was a glory instrument. Guitar or lead vocal.
Sure.
You know, but, and I just thought the bass was great and cool and it was big and thick and heavy.
Yeah.
And around the corner from my house, another thing that ties into the things we began to speak about.
Okay.
Was the Hesse family, Joe and Jim.
Okay.
And Jim played keyboards and Joe played bass. And Joe was the coolest guy in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
They were friends with my older brother and sisters. I was the little kid. I wasn't part of their gang. I was a little kid. But he was always nice to me.
Yeah.
And Joe was a bass player. So at night, I lay in my bed. I was on, you know, I had to go to bed early. And I could hear on our block, he was actually about maybe 50 yards away on our block.
Yeah.
I could hear them rehearse. I could hear the bass traveling. Like you hear a car come down the street with a subwoofer. Now you hear the bass first.
Sure, yeah.
So I think, wow, there's a bass, you know. And I was all excited about Joe. One time he let me pick it up and I plucked it, got a blister right away, you know, so it bit back instantly. And I was just fascinated with this bass thing. And I'd see the guitar player show up to rehearsal carrying like a Fender Twin Reverb, like a briefcase and his little guitar.
Yeah.
And then I see Joe's amp come in off the truck from their show the night before. Yeah. And there's like three guys carrying this bass. They're like, man, a bass, the amps are huge. The strings are thick. It must mean it's way better than a guitar.
Yeah.
The guitar had these thin little strings and a thing. Though I was familiar with guitar, I played some acoustic folk guitar that my sister had in the house. That's how I started.
You come from a big family?
One brother, two sisters.
Okay.
Well, I'm the only musical person. My one sister was almost.
Okay. That's who,
she brought a guitar into the house first, and I started. But so the bass, I was just drawn to the bass right away and fascinated by it. And I remember, you know, the radio's on, and my brother, who used to hang out with Joe, would say, "Yeah, listen, you hear that part right there? That thing? Yeah, that's the bass. Yeah, like Joe plays. Yeah, cool." So, you know, it was just kind of a fascinating thing to me.
Yeah.
And I never looked at it like, of course, it has its basic function. You got to play the bass line of the song.
Yeah.
You got to do that. Yeah. That's supremely important. But I never thought of it as anything that was limited.
Right.
You know, that you can only do this. Matter of fact, Joe was one of the first guys to say to me, "You can't play chords on bass." I said, "Well, Joe, I do it all the time."
Well, yeah, why not?
Check this out. And I was playing chords. Not that you can play it in the body of the song. I see his point. In the main part of a song, you got to be whomping on one giant quarter note or eighth note with the drummer.
Sure.
That's 99% of it. But yeah, you can play chords on bass, but it just appealed to me. And the fingers on strings as opposed to a pick.
Yeah.
I mean, I play guitar with a pick also when I'm writing and stuff like that. But fingers on string was a little more visceral, organic kind of a connection with the instrument.
Okay, yeah.
And
did you ever play with a pick, or was it always fingers?
On bass, always with fingers.
Always fingers, okay.
Guitarist I played with pick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What did your folks do?
My dad was a steam fitter, did heating and air, not so much air conditioning back in the day.
Sure.
They didn't have a steam fitter. They do heating and steam heating in buildings. Then he worked for Bell Aircraft, which became Bell Aerospace.
Okay.
And he was in charge of, he was the West Coast representative for Bell Aerospace during the Minuteman III missile program.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So he did labor jobs, but he also did other jobs that were a little bit more you know, highbrow, if you would say.
Sure.
My mother worked for the Roswell Park Institute, which is a cancer hospital in Buffalo, okay. one of the very first cancer specialist hospitals in the country.
Oh, really? Okay.
And she was, as an administrator, and she would work with several doctors. And I would go, like, she'd have to work late, and I'd go with her to her job.
Okay.
She was in the office, but I could hear something was, oh, pardon me.
Oh, that's fine.
I apologize.
It happens on every podcast listeners. It's fine. It's all good.
I gotta I apologize. I'll turn it off.
It's all good.
I should have thought of that.
No, it's fine.
But she was working late, and I remember I heard it sounds like somebody sawing something. Uh-huh. And they were doing autopsies.
Oh, God.
Downstairs. So they didn't let me watch, but I would talk to the doctors, and they'd tell me, I'm really interested in science a lot. I was a big science buff.
Okay.
Science, chemistry, biology, astronomy, sure. microscopes, all that. I was very much into all that. So she used to bring me slides of the cancer, a super thin slice they would take of a tumor, thin enough that you could see through it. And then it was sealed in glass.
Right.
So I actually had all these interesting different types of cancers, and I could see them in a microscope. So it was kind of an interesting job that she had with that. And then later on, she just did various other things. My parents split up when I was in second grade. My mom got remarried to a wonderful guy. Bob Brost, who was just fabulous, great, handsome, wonderful guy. He was so nice to my mother and so great to us kids, and he supported me.
Okay.
My dad wasn't so much, you know, he didn't like the whole music thing at all.
Oh,
he was
really?
Kind of a hard ass. Okay. But my stepfather, he loved it. He thought it was a wonderful thing that I did.
So they were very supportive of it?
Yeah.
Kind of?
Yeah. And my mom, too. My mom was into a lot of music when I was a kid, too. So she was a big Sinatra, Tony Bennett, just a fan.
Sure.
So the house was always filled with music when I was young. So even before it was rock, there was always good music happening.
Right, right. Okay. So what was the transition from Talis to David Lee Roth that you played with after Talis? Or did you go straight from that?
Talis went through all kinds of permutations, about 7 or 8 versions of Talis.
Okay.
The last version, I was going to do some shows in March.
I think I heard this, yeah.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, it was a Rochester show and a Buffalo show. We got 3 phone calls.
Mm-hmm.
It came in almost all at the same time. We had done it was 2 phone calls. We got a call from Gold Mountain Records.
Okay.
Run by Danny Goldberg, who eventually managed Nirvana.
Okay.
And he wanted to sign a band.
Right.
The next one was from the William Morris Agency. And they said, we got a tour with Yngwie, his first U.S. tour. Mm-hmm. We'd like to have Talis on the bill. We'd like to sign Talis and put them on the bill. I was like, great.
Sure.
Oh, yeah, there was that. And then the third phone call. The third phone call was David Lee Roth's office called, and they want to talk to you about being in his movie. What?
Huh?
It's like,
okay.
What?
And what year was this?
Summer of 85.
Summer of 85. Okay.
So
you'd already met David, obviously, through the Van Halen guys.
Yeah.
Because you were, okay.
Well, met, but that didn't, like, you know, you know, we got to say hello to them a couple times. They were very nice. Eddie was very nice. I didn't talk with Dave much.
Yeah.
Michael was nice. Alex was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And then later on when they were on tour, I go out to the shows because I knew the crew and they let me backstage to say hi.
Sure, yeah.
Freak of nature chance occurrence that happened. I went up to see them in Toronto about 1982 or 3.
Okay.
And I go backstage and Alex is on the couch sleeping. As there, I'm talking to him. Michael's there. Dave's came over to say hello to me.
Yeah.
And they had Chum FM, the Toronto station, on their big stereo system, which is later going to be Party Central back there in their backstage thing, which I didn't get invited to until I was with Dave. Opening acts, no way.
Yeah, not,
you got to leave the building.
Yeah.
So we're sitting there talking, and on Chum FM, out of nowhere, they played my bass solo off the Sacred Teeth end of that record.
You're kidding.
And I go, oh, you got, that's me. They go, oh, you're kidding. Really? And it was, what are the chances?
Right.
Because I just loved Van Halen. I wanted to be in Van. I wanted to just.
Yeah,
Van
of course. Halen.
They were my band. I just, oh, God, this was it.
Yeah.
I should just, please, I just wish something would happen. I could be in Van Halen somehow. But I like Michael, and I hate to see a band change member.
Yeah, sure.
But I thought, who knows what circumstances, but I just loved that band.
Sure.
And Ed, at the end of the 1980 tour, did mention to me, here's my number, don't tell Michael, quote unquote. So we talked a little bit. And then later on, they did ask me, but that, I digress. Uh-huh. Well, we were talking about this, those three phone calls.
Yeah, sure.
So so I found out, we talked with somebody from Dave's office, okay. And they said, because I was about to go out to L.A. to start the tour with Yngwie.
Right.
So they said, when you get here, you got a day off or so, we'll come on out and we'll have a meeting and talk. Okay, so that was great. So I got there, they had a day off.
Yeah.
Dave's partner, manager guy came and picked me up, drove me out to Dave's house. We're there, we're talking, he's saying, yeah, I got, there's a movie and everything, but it's not really a movie. Right. There is a movie, but that's not why I called you. And I said, well, now I got to thicken the plot here a little bit. Okay. When I got to LA, the first thing I did was call Ed.
Right.
I said, Ed, hi, you got to come out to our show. We're playing the country club. And he goes, or wherever we're playing. We're playing at the Palladium.
Okay.
Country club was before.
Yeah.
We're playing the Palladium. I'm playing with him. He goes, I don't know. I go, yeah, well, we're here in town. I got a call from Dave. And he said, and he goes, what? You got it? What? Dave called you? I go, yeah. He wanted me to come out of the house and talk with him tomorrow. He goes, really? We're afraid he might be pulling an Ozzy Osbourne. In other words, quit Black Sabbath and get Randy Rose. And go,
right.
I think he's pulling an Ozzy. Be sure to call me tomorrow for the meeting and tell me what I want. I go, okay. Sorry, man. I didn't know. Okay. I go think, oh, great.
Now like you stuck your foot in your mouth, right? Yeah.
Foot right up to my ankle.
Yeah.
And so I go out to Dave and he goes, there's a movie, but I want to start a band. You and me, we'll find a drummer, we'll find a guitar player. We'll start a band, a tour, there's going to be a movie to launch, but the whole thing, you got to keep it absolutely secret. Keep it, you can't tell anybody. No,
too late.
I didn't know why.
Okay.
So when I got back, I had to make a decision. Do I call Ed and tell him?
Right.
Or not? Yeah. And I said, not.
Yeah.
And decided, if I tell Ed
it's
what happened, and Dave finds out, I'm gone.
Yeah, right.
And plus, that'll be pissed at me anyway in the first place.
Right.
So I just said, well, I'll just keep my mouth shut. And I did. So we did that whole tour to Alice and Yngwie. Me knowing at the end of the tour, I'm going to leave and fly to LA and join Dave, just join the brand new David Lee Roth band. I couldn't say anything.
So you didn't even tell the guys in Talis that you were going to do
nothing,
that?
Okay. Nothing at all, David.
That must have been really difficult.
It was very difficult.
Yeah.
And for me, I always said, I'll never leave Talis. Talis is my band. The only band I'd ever leave Talis for is Van Halen. He said, well, what about David Lee Roth? Close enough. Gone.
Yeah.
And so at the end, I told him, and Dave flew me out to L.A., and we went down to his basement, started writing stuff. Steve Stevens was his first choice for guitar.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But Steve didn't want to leave Billy Idol. It was kind of his thing, right. Built in.
Still with Billy Idol.
Yeah, it was great. Stevens is awesome.
Yeah.
And so I told Dave, I know another Steve. Because Steve Vai was also on the Talis label prior to this other deal we were about to do, Relativity Records.
Yep.
And so I got in touch with Steve Vai because I'd already seen him. And I saw him out and I still wasn't supposed to say anything.
Right.
And I said to Steve, there's something going on. I can't say anything about it, but you might be interested. And he goes, I think I know what it is. I go, well, and we hung out. Matter of fact, somebody took a photo of us. I still have it right at the time we were talking about that. We both had this look on our face like, I think I know what you're talking about. Yeah, but I think I know what you're talking about. So enough, we had Steve down. He's a perfect guy. And he,
sure, of course.
It was a match made in heaven. And so we went on from there. So that was the beginning of that was the transition from Talis. Now, Talis tried to stay together. They got different bass players, stuff like that, but it was a little infighting. It didn't quite work out. And they were,
Were the guys happy for you when you left?
Oh, they were great. Okay. Very cool.
And you're still playing with the same guys who were, is it still the same lineup?
Well, there was two main versions of Talis.
Okay.
One, it was a three piece, which is mostly Buffalo. Then the four piece had guys from it, the drummer, Mark Miller, and the singer, Phil Narrow, were from Rochester.
Okay.
So, unfortunately, recently, because I decided to do some shows with the version 2, the other guys are all pissed off at me now. So, they're, there's no record deal here.
What are you going to do, right?
And I'd already done a whole bunch of reunions with the other ones and stuff. And so, it was crazy that they decided to be that way. But, I wanted to play with these guys, too, because we went through a lot together. It was 2 solid years of performing, and most people know that band, know the version 2 Talis.
Right.
That was the one that toured with Yngwie.
Yep.
Even though the other one toured with Van Halen in 1980, we were pretty much, we were kind of invisible on that tour. We didn't have a record out.
Sure, yeah.
And there wasn't this buzz happening now like there was in 84, 85 with the metal scene and things happening.
Right.
It was kind of the end of the 70s in 1980. And so the second version of Talis got more popular.
Right.
So, but it makes, you know, it breaks my heart that people still want to fight about 34-year-old disagreements, but hey, what can you do?
Well, it's strange because I was in a band with a couple of my best friends growing up, and we still kind of go back to that like sibling sort of thing, and we're all grown men now, and we recognize it when it's happening, but it's like, oh, okay, well, wait, we're not 16 anymore, okay,
It's a funny thing, the relationship with other people in your band is. It sounds funny. I don't mean it in any crazy way, but it's almost like the relationship between a guy and a girl.
Oh yeah,
very much.
It's a marriage for sure.
So much so that if you go out and like jam with some other band, they're gonna, hey, well, I heard you jam with so and so last night.
Yeah, right.
It's kind of like that.
Yeah.
So it's a similar dynamic.
Sure.
Where you know you are supporting each other, but there's still some competition, and you do what you can for each other. One will dominate, one will subjugate a little bit.
Right.
You know, it's a funny thing.
Yeah.
And once in a while you get lucky, and I've been lucky a lot
been able to have a lot of different, you know, little different bands and kind of keep a lot of balls in the air at the same time.
Yeah, it's a quite a juggling act at times, but generally it's a I enjoy playing in a band more than like being the leader and being a solo thing out there.
Sure.
A band for me where everyone has their input. It's more dynamic that way. A lot more ideas come. I think the better bands ever were bands that didn't just have one guy who was in charge of everything.
Sure.
And then everyone else would be in his shadow.
Right.
You know, for me, of course, there's some people that are great like that too.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Depends on the situation. But the Beatles are the classic
band
by which almost all bands are judged one way or the other.
Yeah.
And they all contributed, maybe some more than others.
Sure.
But still, nevertheless, there was a exchange going on there of ideas, which made it fresh and alive in my home.
Yeah. Family. One of the tours that I wish I would have seen, the Eat 'Em and Smile tour, was the drummer that I played with for years went to see that show, and I think was in the front row, and just came back, and I, so much that I remember it. I mean, this was, I don't even know how old I was at the time, but it was a long time ago. And he was going off for about an hour about how great the show was and how animated that you and Steve were, and then David in the middle of it all. What was that tour like for you? Was that like, you'd obviously done a lot of touring with Talis at that point, but was that like a...
Oh, this is now, I launched right into the biggest of the big leagues.
Right.
We were doing sold out stadiums.
Sure, sure.
Or arena, auditoriums. And, Talis, we did good, but we were still, you know, playing clubs.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Once in a while, we did like a 2,000-seater or 3,000-seater with a couple other acts, but we didn't nearly have anything like that.
Right.
And records out. I mean, we had records out, but they're a little, you know, a little small label.
Yeah,
little
sure.
It wasn't Warner Brothers or CBS by far, you know.
Sure.
But it was an amazing launch into a very significant circle of the entertainment industry. Dave was the number one rock star in the world right then.
Right.
1984 had just finished. He did California Girls and Gigolo. All his videos were number one. He was kind of the biggest guy.
Sure.
And suddenly to be up there with him. Now, in the shadow of Van Halen to a large degree, of course, we did a lot of Van Halen songs in the set because we only had one record, Eat 'Em and Smile. So it was, and I love Van Halen, but we kind of did our own thing. And because Dave came from such a high level in the entertainment business to us, though I had done Talis, played all over the place, worked with Michael Schenker, Steve Vai, worked with Frank Zappa. So we touched on it to some degree.
Yeah, right.
But we weren't up to that level.
Yeah.
Where we were the featured guys in an auditorium show with a huge sound and lights and being the headliner. We had never gotten that. But Dave was a pro at it.
Sure.
So I considered my time with Dave like getting a PhD in Showbiz 101.
Sure.
Because he really knew how to do it And he was just, it instinctively knew the right answer to any situation.
Right.
For example, we, you doing okay there?
Oh yeah, fine. Yeah, yeah.
We would do individual solos when the band first started.
Right.
I'd do mine, and then Steve would do his. And
sure.
Each night we'd come out. And it, you know, about three or four shows in, Dave goes, you know, it's boring. There can be more. You know, it's great that you're playing notes. Yeah, it's fabulous.
Right.
But, you know, it's not entertaining.
Yeah.
It's, you know, you're standing there, you're doing the thing. It's real cool if you're a musician. But we should make it like, and he referred to a tractor pull, you know,
at a
county fair where one against the other. And then he got this thing where, and he basically choreographed it. Steve would go out and start playing. I'd come up behind him, grab his guitar, stop it. And then I'd do my thing. He'd come behind me and I'd chase him. He'd chase me and I'm back and forth. And then the whole thing would come up and go back into a song. And the place went out of their mind. But that was all Dave's idea.
Okay.
And, you know, the lighting, Dave's idea. Stage set, Dave's idea. You know, it's
yeah.
He's really knew his stuff. So we learned a lot from him of those things.
Yeah.
Also, just on a personal point of view and how he dealt with things and how he did security. For example, I this isn't so much a secret, but, sure. You know, he would come to his house and he had a very nice house. It was his family house. And it had a gate, uh-huh. You know, to get in, not uncommon.
Yeah.
And Saturday night, you know, we would take a break from rehearsals and go out and get something and come back. And there'd be some kids around the gate. You know, some kids.
Sure. Again. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we'd pull in, and Dave wouldn't even look. And I thought, Dave, you know, Mr., you know, entertainment friendly, friend of everyone, of laughing. And I go, Dave, you know, wouldn't you stop and say hi to the fans? He goes, no. Here's why. If I go out and encourage it, by midnight, somebody's going to be crawling over the fence with a six pack. And he was right.
Yeah.
You know, and it wasn't that he didn't want to be nice to them.
Right.
He just knew what would lead to something else.
Sure, sure.
And he knew, and his security guy, Ed Anderson, mm-hmm. he had security down to a science. And we would go into a room. Ed would, out of 300 people in a room, Ed would automatically know which one was going to be the troublemaker. So he would automatically get in between him and Dave so that, you know, it would
right.
And they just had it down to a science, all these little things.
Yeah.
How they conducted the business of the band and how you got things done.
Sure.
So it was a great, great education. And I was just thrown into the deep end of the entertainment biz pool.
Yeah.
And fortunately, Dave was there to toss me a life preserver and so I wouldn't go down, you know. I learned a lot from him and I took what I learned from him and that was really helped out everything I did since. I think Mr. Big became a success to a very large degree from what I learned from Dave.
Okay. How did that kind of happen?
Well, we after Eat 'Em and Smile, we came home and things changed. During Eat 'Em and Smile, we're writing it in Dave's basement, rehearsing it, mm-hmm. fooling around, hanging out, drinking beer from the US Festival, telling stories. We had a great time. We were all buds. We're all in a gang together.
Sure,
it was so great.
Right.
It was so cool. We go out on Saturday nights, the Troubadour, the Rainbow, all of us together, hanging out. It was heaven. It was amazing. People would freak out. It was Dave.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Going crazy. It was the greatest time you could ever imagine.
Yeah, imagine.
And it was just wild. And but something happened at the end of the Eat 'Em and Smile tour. Things got quiet. Things weren't as fun and friendly. And then we started the Skyscraper tour, and things were noticeably distant and different, and walls and fences were going up,
mm-hmm.
and it just wasn't the same anymore. And Eat 'Em and Smile, we rehearsed and wrote the stuff in the same room. For Skyscraper, Greg would go in and do all his drum tracks to click.
Yep.
Then I'd come in and play bass. And,
oh, so one of those things where you were
and
kind
it was
of
just nobody,
separate,
there was no. Yeah. Something went wrong, or something happened, or somebody said something, or something went south.
Right.
It just was not the same anymore. And the album was just not, I was just not into what was happening on the record.
Uh-huh.
And I just thought, this is a catastrophe, because this is kind of this dance thing going on.
Right.
Now, in retrospect, if that album would have been a huge hit, mm-hmm. Dave would have been the genius of the world, and all would have bowed at his feet.
Right.
But unfortunately, the rock guys don't want to know anything about dance music. And the dance people don't want to hear any music from any guy that ever played rock.
Right.
There's a really solid wall in between those two, and no communication goes between the two. So I give Dave credit for taking the chance, because if it would have worked, man, that would have changed history.
Right.
But it unfortunately, it didn't,
yeah.
for whatever reason.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And a record can fail for all kinds of reasons, not because it's a bad record or a good record. It could be all kinds of reasons that can happen. But it didn't happen. So towards the end of that record, I was just completely unhappy. Uh-huh. They were unhappy that I was unhappy. We went our separate ways. And then I had to kind of start over again.
Okay. And so how did Mr. Big kind of was born out of that? Did you just kind of grab in some buddies' ears?
No, I didn't know what I was going to do. Actually, the first guy I talked to was Steve Stevens.
Oh, okay.
Stevens. There you go. And so because he was now out of Billy Idol, and we talked a little bit about doing something, and he was East Coast, I was West Coast, so it didn't quite work out.
Sure.
Great player, wonderful guy. I still have great respect for him, but it didn't pan out.
Right.
So I started looking for other people, and Ted Templeman befriended me when we did the Eat 'Em and Smile. Uh-huh. Now he's kind of looking out for me. I was kind of very pleased that he did so. And I said, I got a couple things. He goes, bring them to me. When you get something, we'll see what we can do. You got an open door here, so it's cool. So I knew Paul Gilbert already. Okay. He used to come see me play in Talis.
Okay.
I knew Pat Torpe because the last thing I did on Skyscraper was we went and sang background vocals to put on a sampler for the live show.
Okay.
It was me, Pat Torpe, Brett Tuggle, and Dave Amato.
Okay.
Who plays with REO Speedwagon now. And we sang all the songs, all the harmonies for all the songs, but sang them a little faster because they're going to be a little faster live.
Sure.
You can put in a sampler, relatively new technology in that, but they're going to all the vocals.
Yeah,
sampler.
Yeah.
So, but I remember standing there with all those guys. Pat's a great drummer and he sings. Brett's an amazing keyboard and he sings. Dave plays great and he sings. We can just make a pretty good band right there. So Brett, of course, is with Dave, and Dave Amato had another thing, but Pat Torpe, I kept him in mind. Saw him play again later. It was really great.
Right.
Just playing. So I thought, we need a singer. So I looked around, a couple of adventures trying to find a singer. And then
sure.
My buddy Mike Varney up in the Bay Area is famous for finding people and hooking people up. And he goes, I got this one guy. And we always play stuff over the phone back then. You played over the phone. I go, that's exactly what I'm looking for. Blues bass, kind of Paul Rodgers, Steve Marriott, kind of a thing, deep, soulful voice on top of a rock band a la 1971.
Right.
Free,
yep.
Spooky Tooth, Humble Pie.
Yep.
That's what I'm talking.
Yeah.
Perfect. Great. Got in touch with him. Bonus, he was associated with Herbie Herbert. Herbie Herbert was one of the founding fathers of the music business. Put Journey together.
Okay.
In the Woodstock movie, you can see him on the stage moving Carlos Santana's Marshall cap.
Oh, really?
He goes way back.
Okay, okay.
I might be wrong on this, but I believe he was one of the guys or one of the very first guys to say, why don't we sell T-shirts at the show with the band's name
on it? Wow, really?
And that's how Winterland, one of the biggest merch companies, started.
Uh-huh.
He was one of the founding fathers of so much of what became the music business, and I love the guy dearly, and so he was interested in this. So right. I found out, okay, if I get Eric in the band, Herbie's going to manage? He goes, yeah. I'll get involved.
Yeah.
So I thought, man,
cool.
Home run.
Yeah.
So we had a great vocalist. Paul was an amazing guitar player.
Yeah.
Some people were always going to get in there and Racer X it all up. But Paul, first couple songs we did were all like, Motown songs. I remember it was I Don't Want to Lose Your Love Tonight was the first song we jammed on guitar, bass, and drums.
Yeah, okay, right.
And we played Stone songs and stuff. And Pat Torpe was a little worried he was going to be, all blistering sweet picking. But he knew all the chords and the right way to strum it and all these old, cool, great songs. So Pat was right away, this is the guy, it's great. And it worked out really well. So sure enough, that's the birth of Mr. Big. And Herbie eventually got us a deal with Atlantic Records.
Wow.
And Herbie, since he was so powerful in the business, he got us the Rush tour. So
we
did the whole Presto tour opening for Rush. And then later Roll the Bones tour.
Okay.
We did about half of that with them. And then we had other opening slots with all kinds of bands, with Scorpions and Bryan Adams and Aerosmith and all kinds of things because of his, his muscle.
Yeah.
It helped us get into a lot of situations. And To Be With You was a hit because of Herbie. Herbie made that a hit.
Okay.
It had not so much to do with Atlantic Records.
Yeah, that was huge. I remember that,
Yeah, it was gigantic.
Yeah.
And
still is, really. I mean, it hasn't really gone away.
I every time I turn on radio that plays that kind of thing, I end up hearing it.
Yeah, that's great. So let's go from Mr. Big on to the next thing. You have a lot of projects that you've had a hand in.
Yeah.
What was the next thing after Mr. Big?
Well, I started playing with Steve Vai again. he called me up and said, hey, they're doing this G3 thingy, and I got to have a band, so you want to play? And I go, yeah, I'm free for the summer, let's do it. So we did, and we had
sure.
a riot.
Sure.
A great time.
Yeah.
So we ended up doing a solo tour after that, and I joined him for that. I think two other tours.
Okay.
Yeah, I played on one of his records, Real Illusions, mm-hmm. something like that. So and Steve, to this day, is like a brother to me. We're very close.
I saw that you guys played at the NAMM show.
Yeah.
How was that? Was that fun?
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
So cool.
Yeah, it looked good.
What a blast.
One of my good friends actually works for RCF, the company that put that on.
Oh, great.
And he's the bass player that I played with my whole life. And he was like thrilled to death
that
you guys
time.
Were there. Yeah, yeah.
We made a lot of people happy.
Yeah.
That was my goal.
Are there any plans for that to...
No plans. It's if Dave, all of us are of the same mind. If Dave just calls us and says, "Hey, you want to do some shows?" We're all in. So
right.
We'll see what happens.
Right.
We all of us still think highly of him. Would love to play.
Yeah.
Just for it to enjoy.
Sure.
What a great time.
Yeah.
That was. But so I went with Steve. I did a side project called Niacin with Dennis Chambers on drums.
Yep.
Really changed my life as far as a musician goes. Probably more than anyone.
Mm-hmm.
My whole life I played with straight up rock drummers.
Right.
Suddenly this funk soul guy, grandmaster, who can also kill on rock drums.
Right.
A lot of soul and funk and jazz guys can't. Dennis can do anything and he can do it amazingly.
Sure.
And it really got me into looking at things differently time-wise.
Okay.
And expanded a lot of how I think about music and how I approach
it. I was going to ask you about that. Like, do you feel like it's a struggle to try and stay fresh, or are there, for something like that, like to try and look at time in a different way? Because I've had that same sort of thing go on with me. Like, I played with a lot of guys who were right on the money all the time, and I'm just started playing with a drummer who's a little bit more Motown, a little bit more back.
Behind it, yeah.
And I sound like I'm rushing, but I'm not.
Yeah, so did I. Initially, I'm playing with Dennis. Is it Dragon?
Right.
Or is it me?
Yeah, right.
It's you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, I try to keep things fresh. I sit down in my little studio downstairs and mm-hmm. I pound it constantly. My thumbnail is like being torn off by just pushing so hard. And I'm not even on tour. Usually on tour, I tear my hands up really a lot. But for not being on tour, my hands are torn up quite a bit.
Yeah.
I play and practice now more than I ever did. And even as a kid, people come over to my house and my apartment and I have my bass on. You go, hey, don't you ever put that thing down? I go, well, no, I don't happen to put it down very often at all. So I was always a avid practicer.
Uh-huh.
I tried to be an effective practicer too.
Sure.
You sit there and run scales all day and you get nowhere. You're not any better on the show tonight than you were last night. Yeah. Really discovering what it's going to take when you're practicing to really change and move forward and evolve and expand, as opposed to run scales all day.
Right.
Give
me a sense of what that is like for you. Like, what sort of things do you do to?
Well, I'll purposely throw myself a curve.
Uh-huh.
Sit down and learn something that it's not my thing. It's not what I do. You know, sit down with. When I first started doing it with the Brandenburg Concertos box piece, there's violin, viola, and cello solos in this one piece.
Sure.
And I just started to pick them apart and figuring them out. And they're tuned in fifth, so you're flying up and down the neck on the bass, which is tuned in fourth. So it's a harder reach.
Yep.
So it really teaches you to move. And another more recent example, I got a call. There's a young lady in town. Hillary Klug is her name.
Okay.
She is a fiddle player and a clogger. So she dances while she does the fiddle.
Interesting.
Okay. And they wanted to do a remake of The Devil Went Down in Georgia.
Okay, yeah.
And I'm not a country guy.
Right.
I love Nashville.
Yeah.
I love my country brothers and sisters. Fantastic. Maybe old school Johnny Cash what's his name? Conway Twitty. It's kind of so campy. It's good.
Yeah.
You know, but I'm just not a country.
Right.
Never really happened. You know, some of it I can enjoy. So I just thought, well, let me do this.
Yeah,
And I went down. They were kind enough to have me in.
Right.
And so I actually learned a bunch of those fiddle licks in the song to play along with her.
Okay.
Because she was doing it. They were going to do America's Got Talent audition.
Okay.
She's going to do this song and we were going to be the backing track of her up there playing it. So we're recording it all together to do that. And so the, you can't hear it on this, but the,
oh, sure.
The, And really fast and tuned in fifth. So I forgot them now because my RAM is not what it used to be. But I learned a bunch of the fiddle licks, right. And it's a whole different way you gotta, because they're with a bow, they're scraping right and left.
Yep.
And there's your two notes, da-da, and you can move it string to string.
Yeah.
Doing that on bass, two fingers per string, jumping back and forth, it's tough to do. So it put me in a whole different state of mind.
Yeah.
And then again, just learning songs, not necessarily learning fancy bass parts, but just sitting down and learning. Sit down with a Frank Sinatra live at the Sands.
Yeah.
Count Basie Orchestra, Quincy Jones conducting.
Yeah.
It's one of the greatest records ever made.
Yeah.
And play bass to those songs. That's a whole other world.
Right.
That ain't AC/DC. That ain't
Conway
Twitty.
Yeah, yeah.
That ain't,
right.
And it's just in order to play that convincingly.
Uh-huh.
That's a whole different thing. So now when I go back to the music that is my main music, which is rock, hard rock, some of it a little complicated, I got more of a vocabulary.
Right, okay. And
in the language analogy, I believe, holds true.
Uh-huh.
The more vocabulary you have, the better you can describe something.
Exactly.
So I've got a lot more moves that I can make to compartmentalize an idea or an emotion or a feeling or something that you want to express in a song.
Right.
Which is kind of cool. And sometimes people write to me and, I'm in a rut. What do I do? And I go learn Sgt. Pepper's, the whole record. Sit down and learn the whole thing.
Right.
Learn every bass part exactly right, just like Paul McCartney does. Do the whole thing. Don't go improvising on me. Play it exactly like that. Man. And it's not a really difficult bass.
Right.
But it is brilliant bass.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's within a lot of people's striking range to play it.
Sure.
To play it like Paul and to write it like Paul.
Right.
Well, he's probably he's the most successful musician in the world, as far as I know. I think one other guy has a little bit more money.
Right.
But Paul is the most successful. But and I hear back from people saying, yeah, I look at things completely differently now. And I'm not into they're not into the Beatles. I'm not into doing that. It's not what they play. But just learn that.
Right.
And really take great music. And I'm lucky, again, coming from a copy band, we had to come up with a set list of great songs. We had to keep people dancing. You can't go some album deep cut that nobody knows.
Right.
We got to play hits.
Yeah.
Songs that are hits.
Yeah.
And they're great songs because they're hits, and they're hits because they're great songs. So you see, play that all the time.
Right.
You get used to that hit mentality.
Yeah.
You're playing songs that everybody loves.
Right.
So when you write a song, hopefully by osmosis, some of that will work its way into your writing. And I believe that's what happened with the Beatles, because I have a huge iTunes collection, and one big giant portion of it is, I just label it Beatlemania. It's people who play Beatles songs, wrote songs about the Beatles, of different versions of Beatles songs, and it's also a whole bunch of records of songs that inspired the Beatles, songs that they listened to and that they played live. Then you begin to hear the beginnings of Beatles songs in those songs, the Everly Brothers.
Right.
You want to hear the Beatles harmony? It's Don and Phil.
Yeah,
that's where they got a lot of that from. So you begin to see how they're playing great songs as a cover band in Hamburg. Then they start to write. Some of that stuff works its way in.
Yeah.
And since they perform live all the time and can perform, even a song that may not be an A+, they're performing it with such a way that they push it over the edge.
Sure.
So as we began our conversation, all these little factors add up add up to a unified theory at some point, and hopefully comes success.
I was incredibly struck at the Drummer's Dam, and Ray Luzier has the same thing that you do, and I don't know if you can maybe help me understand what this is, but it almost seemed to me, and I explained this to my bass playing friend who's a huge fan of yours, I said it was almost like the PA system couldn't contain what you were doing. And Ray Luzier has that same kind of thing to where it's like the stuff's going to fall over. Are you cognizant of that? Or do you feel that when you're up there? Or what is that?
When we opened for Van Halen, we didn't get a sound check, but they were nice to us.
Right.
And eventually we did get a sound check about three shows in.
Yeah.
And the front of house guy, I remember, is Townsend Wessinger from Shoco.
Okay.
Shoco was the company.
Sure.
In Texas, but my giant PA system.
Yeah.
And I had my full-on giant, huge, massive bass amp, four cabinets across, giant racks of gear, power amps, all pro audio stuff.
Yeah.
And the sound man's out in an empty house, and he's out there, check it out, you know, okay, bass player. And he looks up and he just waves his arms. He goes, bro, you got to turn it down, man. You're gaining on me. I can't get the PA. And the PA is this massive, you know, Van Halen.
Yeah, sure, sure, sure.
You're gaining on me. So we laughed about it. But he meant you gotta bring it down.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
And I did. So, but so it's funny as far as being it's not in competition.
It's not so much a volume thing. It's it's just the way you attack the instrument.
Yeah, and there's a thing. I don't know. Think about it or talk about it much, but. You know, that's why before a
show... Here's your chance.
Okay, here we go. Thank goodness. Before a show, I don't want anybody around. I'm. It's almost like an MMA fighter getting ready to get... And sure. I watch a lot of MMA. I don't know much about it. I just enjoy... It's an entertaining thing.
Sure.
And I see them getting ready to get up there, and they don't know what's going to happen.
Right.
I saw one of the pre-fight interviews recently on one we were watching... And the guy had a perfect analogy of how that works. He goes, talking about what your strategy is for this when you get in the fight. And he looked in the camera and goes, everybody's got a plan until you get hit. and it's true. So you don't know what you're up against, how the audience is going to respond. Yep. It's going to sound different, too. You do sound check all day. You go up to play. It's going to sound different.
Right.
You
know, right. Yeah, right.
Exactly. Have given up doing them as a result. But so I'm just... Never nervous, but I just can't wait to get up there. And there is just an overwhelming surge of energy. And the reason why I made a little parallel with MMA,
sure,
even though it's probably far from being true, I feel like I could come off the stage and get into the ring and kick anybody's ass.
Yeah.
No, I know that's delusional.
Sure.
At best,
it's sure.
My little toothpick arms and my pencil neck. I ain't going to do much. But that's how you feel. And that's the kind of energy that you have up there that you can just... And then when you've got your bass on and you're not necessarily pounding and hitting and smashing the bass.
Right.
But now you have to take that energy and put it into this little delicate articulation on this little chunk of wood.
Right.
And make it... And somehow get that through... With the strings on the wood, the pickup, the chord, speakers, people's ears. So there's quite a chain of things you got to get that energy through. That's the thing I'm most thankful for in my life is I'm driven, relentlessly for more.
Right,
more isn't faster necessarily, or louder,
sure,
or more notes.
Sure,
more can be a zillion things.
Right.
Less is more. Sometimes there's all kinds of more.
Right.
And but I'm always driven to do more. And I'm so thankful for that because I know some people that get bored or indifferent towards their instrument. I remember a famous bass player telling me one time, I got off tour. I put the bass in the closet. I don't get it out till the next tour. And I thought, 12 hours will go by and I go out of my mind.
Yeah.
I mean, I got to have it. If I, you know, travel anywhere, I got to have a bass with me. Are you doing a gig? No. I can't not have a bass with me.
Right.
At all.
Yeah.
Even for a day.
Yeah.
I got to be able to pick it up and go.
Right.
And so I'm supremely, I don't know what causes that or how that came about, but I'm just supremely thankful that it is there.
Yeah. Well, as we're kind of wrapping this up, because we're almost at an hour, that went by very quickly. Fine. And
we're good.
I do a segment at the beginning of the show called Stories from the Road. Now, I know you've been at it forever, and is there one story from all your years of touring or whatever that you can pick out that might be a funny thing or might be a scary thing or whatever that you can think of that you know, a story from the road?
Yeah. Well, we had a couple characters follow us around, especially back in the old days, because we were the band.
Uh-huh.
Girls would come see the band.
Right.
They would hang with the band so they could meet the girls. So
sure.
That was Mother Nature at work.
Yep.
And that's what would happen. And this was before we had much roadie. I would be coiling cords myself and taking shit down and
carrying out to the band. Sure.
You know, it was way early club days, early 70s.
Sure.
And when this guy follows around, his name is Danny. He was kind of, he's a funny guy. No, there's about 10 stories that are amazing about him.
Sure.
I'll tell the one that I think is...
okay.
Less likely to trigger a lawsuit.
Okay. Oh, well, good.
But I'm not going to use his last name anymore.
We don't need that.
Danny so and so. And so he would come out and he would get out on the dance floor and start dancing with the girls. And he was a big guy and a fat guy. And not like this handsome guy, but he's just a ball of fun. Yeah, we loved him. He's a great guy. He's a cool guy. He had glasses on, and he'd get out there. And then we got a spotlight. You know, usually the little house lights we have here, the real little floodlights they have in the ceiling, that would be the band light. Somebody put a little tape red shit over it, but we got a spotlight. And he would put in all three of the bands, you know, open and close an oven, back and forth, get the light exciting. Then he'd go dance with the girls some more and buy people drinks and me. But, and he'd get the place going. We had no time. We'd have the place to be partying, having a great time.
Yeah.
And we hung with him. He was a great, fun guy. But we knew also that he had a dark side. Especially if somebody went after us in the band.
Sure.
I've seen him snap at people.
Yeah.
And that was funny. A little rain.
Is he here?
Could be sure. Perfect. The ghost of Danny. I think he's still around. Who knows? We'll find out tomorrow. But so we played this club, the Club Lakewood. Now, Club Lakewood is famous. One of the places, we played three shows in one day one time.
Okay.
Downtown Buffalo.
Yep.
For the 1M&T Plaza Bank launch crowd.
Right.
Then we went to Niagara Falls to play right after the Buffalo Bills football team practice session.
Okay.
Then we left from there and went to the Club Lakewood.
All right.
So that was that's the club we played. Now, we played there a couple of times. We played there one time, and there was a fight about the money at the end of the night. Now, one of the other guys in the band would collect the money, and he was just a little guy, too, so he wasn't about to go throwing punches at the bouncers and everything.
Sure.
And so I didn't really know about it. All of a sudden, I heard some kerfluffle off in the distance and people yelling and screaming. And they, turns out there was a big fight with it. So Danny is in there, you know, sticking up for the band. And they're screaming and yelling and shit being thrown. And it really got ugly fast. I don't know what happened. We get our money. We did not get our money. So, well, let's wait. Let's talk to the agent. Let's talk to our manager. Some big fight about something going on. And there was a big problem with Danny and a couple bouncers squared off. And the bouncers could have pummeled him. And he was soft muscle. He wasn't a big muscular guy.
Yeah.
But he was a maniac. And I've seen him fight. And I saw him fight a huge muscular guy. And he trashed the guy. He just loses his mind.
Right.
And,
never fight
a lunatic.
Right.
You know? So we, you know, calmed it down. Danny, it's okay. Cool. We'll go. It's going, no, I want to go back there. Goes, oh, that's all right. That's all right. You know, let's just leave. Go. We got the gear. We got our stuff. We got out. Let's just get out of here. Go home. We'll deal with it later.
Sure.
So we go home. That's the end of it. The next day, the Club Lakewood burned to the ground.
Oh, God.
I have no idea who did. Coincidence? Maybe. Probably. But then it's all wooden club on the shore of the Lake Ontario, the Club Lakewood, beautiful place. Burnt to a cinder.
Wow.
Gone.
Okay.
Never. So.
So. So you never know.
You never know. So message to club owners. You never know how crazy somebody is. And again, I have no idea. I didn't see anybody light a match. I had never heard anything. But through the years, I kind of put two and two together.
Right.
And I think there's a possibility
that
something might have happened.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Billy, thank you so much for taking the time to do this, man. It's been an honor chatting with you.
Thanks for coming over in the rain.
It's fine.
I apologize for the weather, but...
Well, it is all your fault.
Yeah, it's gonna break soon.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it so much.
My pleasure. Thanks,
buddy. Awesome.
And that is it. I hope you enjoyed my talk with Billy Sheehan. My huge thanks to him again for taking time out of his incredibly busy schedule to talk with me. Thanks, Billy, if you're listening. You can find Billy Sheehan online at billysheehan.com. He's also at Billy on Bass on Twitter and at Billy Sheehan on Bass on Instagram. While you're at it, why not give me a follow on the socials as well? I am at Michael J Music. That is at M-I-C-H-A-E-L letter J M-U-S-I-C on Facebook and Twitter. And I'm at Michael J Official on Instagram, also at Turn It On Podcast on Facebook. And send me your stories from the road if you have any, because I'm gonna run out eventually. Send them in and I'll read them, because I am a cool guy. Send them to letter M, letter J at tiopod.com. That is MJ at tiopod.com, or on the contact page at tiopod.com. If you or anyone you know is interested in advertising here on Turn It On, you can also reach me at any of those places. We also have a PayPal donation button on our website. If you're feeling saucy, go ahead and drop us a few bucks to help us keep the lights on over here. You don't have to donate, but I'd love you forever if you do. I'll name my next guitar after you. Okay. Thanks again for listening. I'm off to Canada for a 10-day run of shows with my buddy, my boss, Aaron Goodvin, who now has the number one song on the Canadian Billboard country music charts. Yes, his record V just came out everywhere, so check that out as well. This is going to be a really fun week. Cold, but fun. Thanks again, everyone, and I will see you again next time here on Turn It On. More shows coming your way. Cheers.